Radiolab, which has often been featured on The Science Show, was writ large in the New York Times last week on Thursday, and there's a link on the Science Show website. And they're making an impact around the world. So why do some people hate them? Could it be physiology? Here's an example of their work, and Jed Abumrad and Richard Krolwich then explain why it's toxic to some.
When I woke up, I remember just sitting there, and I'm in this little white space. I actually had no idea who I was, who am I, where I was, or what I was doing. Why am I doing this? So I'm sitting in this little white ball, and I'm looking around, and what is this all about? I hear this beeping. There's this white light beeping. And then at that moment, I realize that I'm in a little room and that I'm supposed to do something, and that one of the things I'm supposed to do is press that button. So I press the button. And at that moment, I realized, holy mackerel, I'm a pilot, I'm in an airplane, and I'm not flying it. And I grabbed the controls, and then just in a giant rush. I'm Tim Sestak. I'm a pilot. I'm flying in the centrifuge. All came back to me at once, and I was okay.
Commander Sestak, Dr. Bennett, how are you feeling?
Again, like I've been gone a long time.
There are stunning silences. There are times when the sounds are slightly piled up on each other. And the instinct to do that will raise in some quarters some questions like, what experience are we having here? Mm-hmm. Ours or his? At the same time, I mean, here's our argument. We are manipulating reality to a degree.
Yeah, how I would put it is that in the case of the thing you just heard, I mean, you have to follow the story, I guess. He's in a white space, kind of womb-like. All of a sudden, oh my God, I'm in a plane. I have to fly the plane. And then, oh my God, I'm Tim Sestak. It's like this whole journey of life in this little moment. So all that the sound is doing there, I mean, there is some emotional information that's being conveyed. But really, it's just sort of hammering each point of transformation. It's saying, in a kind of punctuational way, it's giving a kind of exclamation point on each one.
And we do this to ourselves. In the sections in which we're talking back and forth and arguing, and they are real, actual conversations, we are very conscious of the musicality. So there will be times when he will say, basically, take it down. Because this is like a difference in age. I mean, if you're born in the 50s and 60s and stuff, or you're born in the 80s and 90s, I think you have different jokes, different music, different conversations in your head, a whole different set of how you read life.
In deference to you, you often tell us to get interested, stop being so mellow.
But we are having absolutely a generational struggle in the middle of all this. What we end up doing in these conversations in the studio is I go, less. I go, less? He goes, yeah. So I go, and it's frankly incomprehensible to me.
Still, even now. Yeah. I mean, it is the middle space. The middle space between your tendency toward want to perform in a more forward way and my tendency to want to kind of lean back. There is that middle ground, which I hope the show kind of lives in, which neither of us could come up with on our own.
No. And we both share, in fairness, this idea about touching at a distance.
Okay, here I played a clip from one of my personal heroes, Walter Murch. He's a great film editor who did The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, Cold Mountain, a million other great movies. And he is a great thinker about editing and sound.
As far as we can tell from the evolutionary record, the oldest sense that we have is either the sense of smell or the sense of touch. That's how amoebas and bacteria is used to navigate around in the world. Hearing is a very refined sense of touch. And of all the five senses, it's the latest to be developed by living entities on Earth. The paradox about hearing is that as the child is growing in the womb, it's the first of the senses to get hooked up about 4.5 months after conception, which is to say halfway through gestation. The child begins to hear. Now, the child is not seeing anything because it's dark in there. The child isn't tasting anything or smelling anything, but hearing, for all intents and purposes, the world into which the child is developing, which is to say the mother's middle, is full of sound. It's got the mother's heartbeat 24 hours a day. It's got her breathing 24 hours a day. The gurgling of her intestines at certain times of day. It's got her voice. And remembering that the womb is pretty thin, there's nothing to prevent sounds from outside, the father's voice, music, penetrating in and being heard by the developing child.
So sound as touch starts way, way early.
Okay, so moving right along, we then played a clip from a segment from our musical language show, which looks at a particular piece of music, Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and what it can teach us about how our brains deal with unpleasant noises. Stravinsky premiered The Rite of Spring. It was a ballet. Nijinsky did the choreography. And when it premiered, all hell broke loose. Robert and Jonah Lehrer do the play-by-play.
So let's begin. First, just set the scene.
This is May 1913.
It's a spring night.
Black tie costumes. The women have their fedoras.
This was evening clothes.
Yeah, well, this was the Russian ballet. This was high art.
And the program said this is a concert about springtime. But as they settled into their seats, it turns out that what Stravinsky had in mind was not spring like honeybees. No, the spring Stravinsky had in mind was about change, about radical change. Ritual murder.
Literally, that's what the story of the play is. It's a pagan ritual where at the end the virgin gets massacred.
Oh, dear.
But the music itself is fascinating. The beginning is this very charming bassoon. It's a classic Lithuanian folk tune. And it does sound like the earth is warming. And that lasts for about a minute. And then we get some tutti of flutes, and it's lovely. It's getting a little more disturbing. And then about 3 minutes into it, everything changes. There's just an earthquake. Stravinsky plays this chord. There's a great story that when Diaghilev, who was the head of the Ballet Russe, first heard this chord, and Stravinsky was playing it on the piano for him, he asked Stravinsky, "How long will it go on like that?" And Stravinsky looked at him and said, "To the end, my dear." And it literally does. That chord structures the music. It's one of the most difficult sounds you've ever heard. It is just the stereotype of dissonance. It hurts you.
Huh. Well, what happened?
Well, after about 3 minutes, they rioted.
Meaning what? Like they screamed or threw?
They screamed. There was blood. Old ladies were hitting each other with canes.
Why were old ladies? Old ladies should have gone and hit Stravinsky with a cane.
But once they started screaming, Stravinsky ran backstage and by some accounts was crying. Nijinsky was off on the side of the stage screaming to his dancers to keep the beat.
Wow.
Quite the fiasco. And the question is why.
You know what I love about that? It's 3 minutes simply to ask a question. Which is a question we're interested in, which is like, why does music sometimes create such intense emotion, not always good emotion? And the why that we go on to sort of answer subsequently is that it turns out, and this is new science and it's speculative science, we should say, there are these gangs of neurons in a particular part of your brain called the auditory cortex that are responsible for decoding new sound. And they generally do a really good job, but every so often they hear sounds which are relentlessly new, which it was in this case. When they fail and they can't decode the sounds, they squirt out some dopamine. Now, dopamine is not always a bad thing. A little dopamine makes you feel happy. That's why sex and drugs and chocolate and various things make you feel good. But too much dopamine has been shown clinically to cause schizophrenia. Now, we don't want to oversimplify schizophrenia, but perhaps, and this is the argument we put forward, what happened that night was that their brains flooded with dopamine, and they literally went crazy.
And then we go on to propose that a year later in Paris, This same guy comes back to the same hall, plays the same piece of music, and this time he's carried out on the shoulders of the crowd. 25 years later, Mickey Mouse is performing this particular piece with Toscanini, and it's become almost kiddie music. So then we ask, what happened? How did the music that was so fierce, so new, and so disturbing on Monday become kiddie music on Thursday? And that leads to another notion about the brain, that it is a very conservative organ, and it steals from artists.
Yeah, it's... You're going to have to explain that a little bit.
Well, I don't think I will. But what was very cool afterwards is it turns out that with this speculative notion, again, Walter Murch on the phone with Ellen is talking. We send him the piece and say, what do you think? And he says, not only do I think this, I did this.
A number of years ago, I was working at a radio station in New York, which is now defunct, called WRVR. And I was assigned the job of cataloging the record collection. And they played mostly classical music. They had a jazz section, but it was mostly classical music. I found myself in the basement in a room full of records, and I was supposed to type out a card for each of the records. And I thought, well, I'll just use this opportunity to teach myself musical history. So I began at the beginning of what they had, which was a couple of shelves of Gregorian chants. And so for 2 weeks, I saturated myself in that music from 9 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night whenever I went home, listening to nothing but those tonalities. And then for some reason, I had to go up to the control booth to ask Gordon, the engineer, a question. So I ran up the stairs and opened the door to this cacophony of sounds. And I had for a moment exactly what I imagined the people at the Rite of Spring experienced, which was a kind of a cognitive dissonance. What is this? Why is this radio station playing this kind of musical nonsense? I literally clapped my hands to my ears and said, Gordon, what is this music? And he sort of casually leaned over and picked up the album, and it was Bach's St. Matthew Passion.
No, if you've never heard Bach's St. Matthew Passion, this is what it sounds like.
Oh, the horror.
In 2 weeks, I had managed, without knowing it, to reset my neuronal musical receptors to the kind of music that existed before the 16th century. We think of Bach as being the symbol itself of musical respectability. And yet here I was coming suddenly and unexpectedly upon Bach and hearing the dissonances that are dissonant only when you compare them with the 15th, 16th centuries.
How perceptions change, maybe with Radiolab too, for some listeners. Next week on The Science Show, biochar and peak oil. On Catalyst, Roadkill and Catlapping. On SBS Television, the story of science continues on Tuesdays at 8:30. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune, with music by Johann Sebastian Bach and Igor Drive Me Crazy Stravinsky. I'm Robin Williams.